Hello, everyone. Thank you so, so much for joining this OneLab Network event, recognizing, identifying, and reporting the identification of select agents and toxins. My name is Chelsea Parsons, and I'm a consultant with Guidehouse supporting CDC's OneLab initiative. I have just a couple notes for everyone before we dive into this session. If you're having any technical issues throughout the session, you can feel free to email our OneLab inbox. It's onelab@cdc.gov. That's onelab@cdc.gov. If you have questions throughout the session regarding the session materials, you can pop those into the Q&A function. So in the bottom ribbon of your Zoom panel right now, you should see a Q&A. You can pop questions in there throughout the entire session. We'll have a Q&A section at the very end of the event. Try to answer as many as we can. If we don't get to your question today, or if something pops up after the session you have a question about, feel free to email that OneLab inbox again. That's onelab@cdc.gov. And if you submit a question through the Q&A we don't get to today, we'll try to get back to you with a response in a timely manner there. So I want to note that we've posted the live captions link in the chat, but please be sure if you're going to use that to keep both the live captions link open as well as this Zoom session too. Just keep them up side by side. All right, so let's get into our agenda for today. We are gonna have some opening remarks from Dr. Victoria Olson of OLSS. Alicia Branch, our OneLab lead, will introduce us to today's presenters. We'll get into the main conversation, and then we'll close out with that Q&A. We'll be providing some instructions to obtain PACE credits at the very end of the session and then talk to you a little bit about our upcoming events. So with that, I'll turn it over to Alicia Branch for our intro. Thanks, Alicia.
Thank you, Chelsea. We at DLS want to say happy 48th Medical Laboratory Professionals Week, or Lab Week. Our theme for this week, this year's Lab Week, is the Futures Lab. We say thank you to all laboratory professionals on the call today. We celebrate you this week and every day for protecting the future by skillfully adapting to meet today's evolving public health challenges and patient care through reliable diagnostics and prevention with resilience, innovation, and expertise. Please join us in celebrating Laboratory Week by participating in DLS Lab Week activities. First, celebrate yourself for your outstanding contributions. And then always add in your exceptional laboratory, any laboratory professional that's in your life. Use our digital toolkit to increase awareness of laboratory contributions by sharing social media hashtags, key messages, digital graphics with your colleagues. Also, you can download printable stickers, a coloring page, and a word search puzzle. See the link in the chat for the DLS Lab Week Toolkit. And at this time, it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Victoria Olson, the Deputy Director here at CDC's Office of Laboratory Science and Safety, who will provide the opening remarks.
Thank you so much, Alicia, and thank all of you for allowing me to join you here on your OneLab Network call. As Alicia was just mentioning, this week is Medical Laboratory Professional Week, or how we affectionately like to call it, Lab Week. Lab Week's purpose is to increase public awareness and appreciation of the clinical and public health laboratory community. I'm personally honored to celebrate Lab Week with all of you today. I want to recognize that you do essential services to safeguard the public health, and it's not only during public health emergencies, even though that seems like it's been ongoing for years now, but it also is every day. Laboratory scientists are our critical partners, and we value this collaboration immensely. I want you to know that we are here to support you and have resources to help you meet the demands of your everyday duties. And that includes during those never-ending public health emergency responses. I am in awe of how much hard work and your continued dedication to strengthening diagnostic testing and improving patient care through the rapid detection of disease. So I just wanted to take a few minutes to extend my appreciation and thank you for letting me have this time. I'd like to personally wish each of you a happy Lab Week, and thank you again for your remarkable contributions and continued commitment to improving public health. And now I'll turn things back over to Alicia. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Olson, for joining us today and providing opening remarks. Before we present our speakers for today, we would like to provide the following disclaimer. I'm sorry, I actually changed the slide. CDC, our planners and presenters, wish to disclose that we have no financial interests or other relationships with manufacturers of commercial products, suppliers of commercial services, or supporters. Now we're excited to introduce today's presenters for a part one of a two-part One Lab event. Our first presenter is Ms. Susanna Swink, a microbiologist Form 4 coordinator with CDC Division of Select Agents and Toxins, or DSAT. Before joining DSAT in 2021, she worked as a public health scientist at CDC and the Texas Department of Public Health. Dr. John McQuesten will deliver the second half of today's presentation. John earned a BS from the State University New York Fredonia, an MS degree from Virginia Tech, specializing in molecular genetics, and a PhD in evolutionary genetics from Emory University. He is a team lead for the Special Bacteriology Reference Laboratory in the Bacterial Special Pathogens branch within the Division of High Consequence Pathogens and Pathology at CDC. Our One Lab speakers for today, Ms. Susanna Swink and Dr. John McQuesten.
Thank you, Alicia. Good afternoon. Today's presentation will cover a brief overview of the Federal Select Agent Program, commonly referred to as FSAP. Regulations for submitting the APHIS CDC Form 4A and provide some helpful information on completing the form. Next slide, please. FSAP is managed jointly by CDC, Division of Select Agents and Toxins, and Division of Agricultural Select Agents and Toxins at APHIS. In the United States, there are two types of entities for the Federal Select Agent Program: those registered and those not registered, or non-registered entities. Excuse me. Registered entities are laboratories approved to work with select agents and toxins through the registration with the Federal Select Agent Program. There are approximately 233 registered entities, which include academic, federal government, non-federal government, commercial for-profit, and private nonprofit companies. Non-registered entities are not approved to work with known select agents and toxins and make up the majority of labs in the United States. Examples include hospital, clinic, food testing, and veterinary laboratories. More information about the Federal Select Agent Program can be found at our website, selectagents.gov, that is listed in the chat. Next slide, please. I'll cover the regulations and reporting specifics for the identification of a select agent or toxin. Next slide, please. The APHIS CDC Form 4A is for reporting the identification of a select agent or toxin and is used to notify the Federal Select Agent Program of the identification of a select agent or toxin contained in a specimen presented for diagnosis, verification, or proficiency. Today, we'll concentrate on reporting select agent and toxin identifications on the APHIS CDC Form 4A, Sections A and B, and C and D. A link to the form will be posted in the chat for your reference. This form can be used for various sample types, including human, animal, environmental, food, and plant. The report can only be used to report one select agent or toxin. A different agent or toxin identification will have to be submitted on a separate form. This form is used by both APHIS and CDC and can be submitted to either agency. Later in the presentation, I'll talk about disposition. Listed on this slide are the regulations. Next slide, please. Listed on this slide are the regulations from the Code of Federal Regulations, or CFR, that are specific for the select agents and toxins. Title VII, Part 331, covers agricultural regulations. Title IX, Part 121, covers animal and animal products. And Title 42, Part 73, covers public health. We won't have time to go into the specifics of them, but they can be found at selectagents.gov, or once the slides are posted, you can select the hyperlinks in the slide. Sections of the regulation that specifically apply to non-registered entities that possess or use or transfer a select agent or toxin contained in a specimen presented for diagnosis or verification are Title VII, Part 331, Section 5, Title IX, Part 121, Section 5 and 6, and Title 42, Part 73, Sections 5 and 6. On the next slide, I'll go over those specific requirements. Next slide, please. The regulations allow for non-registered entities to be exempt from registering with the Federal Select Agent Program and meeting the requirements of the regulations, provided that they do the following. Report the identification on a completed and signed Form 4A within 7 calendar days after the identification to either APHIS or CDC, but not both agencies. Secure the select agent or toxin to prevent theft, loss, or release while in the entity's possession. Next slide, please. In addition to these requirements, the regulations require that a select agent containing a select agent be transferred to a registered laboratory or destroyed on-site by a method that will kill the select agent. Select agents and toxins, as well as samples containing select agents and toxins, should not be taken off-site for destruction by a commercial hazardous waste vendor, but instead destroyed on-site. Some common methods of destruction include autoclaving, chemical treatment, and incineration. This we'll cover later in more detail in the presentation. Both the transfer and destruction must take place within 7 calendar days. We previously discussed your lab is required to report the select agent or toxin identification to APHIS or CDC, but you're also required to report the identification results to the specimen provider and your state or local authorities when required by local law. Let's move on to immediate notification and which agents and toxins require immediate notification. Next slide, please. The Federal Select Agent Program currently regulates 68 select agents and toxins. Please visit our website at selectagents.gov for the entire list. The identification of any of the Tier 1 select agents or toxins listed on this slide must be immediately reported by telephone, facsimile, or email to the Federal Select Agent Program. Agents most frequently identified and reported to the Federal Select Agent Program are botulinum neurotoxins. Botulinum neurotoxin producing species of Clostridium and Francisella tularensis. Next slide, please. So let's talk a little bit about immediate reporting and completing the form. The date of notification on the form, Block B3, is the date the laboratory identifying the select agent or toxin notified either APHIS or CDC. This date is usually reported by the reference lab and is captured only on the Form 4A Sections A and B, which is also known as Part 1 of the form. This is not the date your laboratory immediately notified the sample provider or physician. Again, immediate reporting can be done by fax, phone, or email. Next slide, please. Now let's discuss the date the sample provider was notified by the testing or reference laboratory. First, a sample provider is the person or facility that your testing or reference laboratory receives the sample from. There are times when there are more than one sample provider, such as when both the hospital and the state public health laboratory receives the sample from the same patient that you identified as containing a select agent or toxin. In this case, both sample providers would be listed. Please list all sample providers so we can follow up with them to ensure appropriate disposal of any samples containing a select agent or toxin and to verify if any potential exposures occurred. The date the sample provider was notified may be the date after the identification date. This is not the date of a presumptive or a preliminary identification. We recommend that notification to the sample provider be made as soon as possible after the final identification of a select agent or toxin. When notifying the sample provider, please request they complete and sign a Form 4A, Section C and D, or Part 2. This helps us in obtaining the information on the form and quickly identifying possible exposure incidents. In the next slides, I'll provide some helpful information for a few questions on the Form 4A, Section C and D. Next slide, please. The date the sample provider is notified by the testing or reference laboratory is captured in block D2 on the Form 4A, Section C and D. The date is often misunderstood and should be the date the reference laboratory provided the final identification of the select agent or toxin to your laboratory. This is not the date for any presumptive or preliminary identification. Since we'll already have sections A and B of the Form 4A with the date the reference or testing laboratory has indicated as the date they notified the sample provider, this date should match that date. If these dates do not match, we may contact either entity to verify the date that the information was provided. Next slide, please. The number of samples shipped. This question is asking you to count the number of items your lab shipped to the reference lab. This would normally include counting each sample, plate, slant, tube, etc., for each patient, meaning the number would be 3 if you sent one blood culture, one slant, and one plate for patient X for the identification of Brucella. If your laboratory sent multiple samples from different sources, only include the number of samples that were positive for the identification of the select agent. For example, if your laboratory sent 10 mosquito pool samples for Eastern equine encephalitis testing, and only 8 of the samples were positive, your laboratory would report 8 in this box, even though 10 samples were shipped. Next slide, please. The zip code information is the only patient-related information that we require on the form. This information should not be the zip code of the laboratory performing the testing or the facility that collected the sample. It should be the information specific to the patient when known. If not known, the hospital or treatment facility zip code can be provided. Please do not provide any other patient-related or PII information, such as name, date of birth, address, ages, etc. Also, please do not send additional documents containing information not related to the APHIS CDC Form 4A. Our system is not rated to contain PII information. This zip code is important because it helps us understand where in the United States these infections in humans, animals, or the environment are occurring. We use this information to track and trend data over time. Next slide, please. The sample disposition is important information to have and to understand how laboratories are taking appropriate safety measures to properly destroy select agents or toxins. This question is on both parts of the form. We need to know the disposition of the select agent or toxin, as well as know how the original samples containing the select agent or toxin were either transferred, destroyed, or retained. That is, retained only by entities registered with the Federal Select Agent Program. I'll repeat that again. Only entities registered with the Federal Select Agent Program can retain samples containing viable or active select agents or toxins. If the select agent or toxin has been inactivated or made non-viable or non-toxic by an acceptable method, then the material can be retained by an entity not registered with the Federal Select Agent Program. An example would be a formalin-fixed paraffin-embedded tissue sample identified as containing Coxiella burtonettii. In this case, your laboratory would indicate destroyed on the Form 4A and provide the method as paraffin-embedded formalin-fixed tissue. Please call us or refer to our website for more information about samples containing a select agent or toxin and if your laboratory can retain these samples. All isolates and samples containing a select agent or toxin that cannot be retained must be appropriately destroyed on site. The most common destruction methods include autoclaving. Using 10% bleach is another one. However, other methods include, but are not limited to, other chemicals, incineration, and irradiation. Please refer to the Biosafety in Microbiological and Biomedical Laboratories document, Appendix I and K, for more information on the appropriate method to destroy the select agent or toxin. If you would like the isolate or sample containing the select agent or toxin transferred, please first contact the laboratory that will receive the select agent or toxin material to ensure they are registered to receive that particular agent or toxin. Next slide, please. This slide is like the previous slide, except it is for section C and D. It does not have an option to transfer, but does include the selection option that the entire specimen was transferred to the reference laboratory. This is quite often the case for stool samples identified as containing botulinum neurotoxins. Again, retaining the select agent or toxin isolate or samples containing the select agent or toxin is not allowed for entities not registered with the Federal Select Agent Program. Next slide, please. The final aspect of the form, and perhaps the most important aspect I will cover, is the question, were any samples containing a select agent or toxin handled outside of primary containment, which may have led to the unintentional release and/or exposure to the select agent or toxin? This is seen on the screen in question D9 or for Section C and D. However, this question is also on Sections A and B, question B10. If your response is yes for this question, an AFIS CDC Form 3 is required. We hope to get few yes responses. However, we have received many over the years, mostly related to working with or manipulating select agents or samples containing select agents on the laboratory open bench. Part 2 of this presentation next month will go over the AFIS CDC Form 3 and related statistics. Next slide, please. Now let's test your knowledge with a few scenarios. You should see a poll pop up on your screen so you can participate. Next slide, please. Your hospital laboratory received 2 serum tubes and a wound swab from a patient that the doctor suspects has botulism. Your laboratory appropriately packages and ships the samples to the State Health Department laboratory. 3 days later, State Health Department lab contacts you with a positive identification of botulinum neurotoxins for the wound swab. Is your hospital laboratory required to submit an AFIS CDC Form 4, Section C and D? So we'll give you about 15 seconds to select your response. Okay, so maybe we can wrap up that poll. And let's go to the next slide, please. The correct response is yes, because the select toxin was identified. Next slide, please. From scenario A, your hospital laboratory received 2 serum tubes and a wound swab from a patient that the doctor suspects has botulinum. Your laboratory appropriately packages and ships the sample to the State Health Department laboratory. 3 days laboratory, the State Health Department lab contacts you with a positive identification for botulinum neurotoxin from the wound swab. What number of samples would you indicate for question D3 on the AFIS CDC Form 4, Section C and D? And we'll give you 15 seconds or so to respond to the poll. Okay, we're wrapping up the poll. Let's go on to the next slide. The correct response is C1, because only the wound swab was tested and positive for the select toxin. Next slide, please. Your hospital laboratory identifies Brucella abortus RB51 in a patient's blood sample. Should your laboratory submit a completed AFIS CDC Form 4A Sections A and B? And we'll give you a couple of minutes to look at those responses and answer the poll. Okay, it looks like the poll closed. And so maybe we can go ahead and advance to the next slide. The most accurate response is C, no, because Brucella abortus RB51 is not a select agent. We have seen Form 4s reporting misidentified select agents and toxins and non-select agents. So please be sure to let us know if the sample was sent to another laboratory for further identification. Also, be reminded that a presumptive identification does not require reporting with a Form 4A. Once the sample is sent to the reference lab and confirmed as a select agent or toxin, that is when we should receive the Form 4A from both the reference laboratory and the laboratory submitting the sample for identification. That ends my presentation today, and I'll take questions at the end, or you may post your questions in the Q&A section. Thank you very much.
All right. Let me click this over to presentation view. Okay, hi everyone. I'm John McQuiston. I'm the second speaker for today. And today I'm gonna be talking about Molitov and the limitations, misidentifications, and safety with regards to Molitov in general. Just as an overview, I'm gonna talk a little bit about Molitov and taxonomy, and why does taxonomy have to be so confusing? The safe handling of the Molitov specimens, and then database importance, a few slides on MicrobNet, and then some conclusions. So bacterial identification has gone through phases over the years, and for many years we used biochemical and phenotypic tests for identifications, but they really are too slow and too expensive to continue using. We also use PCR, but their PCRs are generally very specific for a species or a strain level. We're starting to use genomics, and that's too slow, too expensive, and really too much expertise is needed, at least for now. We are moving in the right direction, I think. But Molitov kind of fits in that area that's just right. Molitov is one of the fastest, easiest, and inexpensive specimen to result laboratory tests ever developed for thousands of bacterial and fungal species. It really can identify bacterial species in less than 10 minutes per sample for prep time. That's the full extraction method. You can do hundreds of specimens per day with accurate results within minutes. It costs about 50 cents per isolate. That's excluding the equipment and staff, of course. And it's accurate to the genus and species level. And there are a few publications taking it down to the strain level in E. coli and some other species. And there's a new infrared technology that'll go to the strain level as well. It also can identify some antimicrobial resistance markers. And even with all of this, though, it's not perfect. The biggest question I get every time I go and talk about MALDI-TOF is, why can't I differentiate X species? This happens all the time, and many of the common species people have trouble differentiating in MALDI-TOF are really because of the limitations of the instrument and the technology. It's really only accurate to the species level, at least for now, with a few recent exceptions. The results are really only as good as your database representation and quality. And then, of course, the taxonomists get in the way. Now, misidentifications have happened in all of the technologies we've used to try to identify species, including cross-reactivity in PCR, contamination in genomics, lateral gene transfers can cause confusion in molecular tests, and taxonomic and nomenclature issues and species relatedness really are what plague the MALDI technology. One of the, probably the single most question I get asked about species relatedness is the Shigella and E. coli. And Shigella and E. coli on the MALDI-TOF will be misidentified. Shigella's come up as E. coli, E. coli's come up as Shigella's. And you can see here from this screenshot of MicrobeNet, the results page shows that a Shigella thonii came up as an E. coli as the detected species and matched the Bruker library. If we were to look at the top 10 hits for that, that strain, you can see it's a mix of E. coli and Shigella species and genera. And these are also mixed between the databases. And this has been a long challenge for differentiating E. coli and Shigella. And E. coli and Shigella are actually taxonomically two different genera according to taxonomists. But according to doing whole genome sequencing and matching them up, and most people recognize this now that E. coli and Shigella species are closely related and genetically constitute the same species. This is why they can't be differentiated on the MALDI-TOF instrument. Another problem we have is the Brucella and the Ochrobacterium. And this is leads directly to the select agent problem. Many Ochrobacterium have been misidentified, or many Brucellas have been misidentified as Ochrobacterium on MALDI-TOF as well as VITEC and some other technologies. And that's because they are very closely related species and genus. And in 2020, Port et al. Published an analysis of 1,000 type strain genomes and determined that Brucella and Ochrobacterium should actually be in the same genus. So just recently, they have now added the Ochrobacterums to the Brucella genus. And we look at it as the new Brucellas, formerly known as Ochrobacterium, and the old Brucellas, which also contain the select agents, Brucella suis, Abortus melitensis, and others. So if you are seeing Brucella and Ochrobacterium names changing in the current databases, just be aware that Brucella is, that Ochrobacterium has been renamed as Brucella. Now there's a great publication out from ASM called Brucella and Ochrobacterium Taxonomic Updates for Laboratory. I highly recommend you read this if you deal with either of these, and most people probably will deal with Ochrobacterium at some point, and make sure that you understand what to do with the Ochrobacterium and Brucellas. But even within the Ochrobacterium and Brucella, there's arguments. Taxonomists love to argue about what's a species and what's not a species. And you can see this with Brucella lupini, which is formerly Ochrobacterium lupini, where this publication in 2019 said the species is a later heterotopic synonym of Ochrobacterium anthropi, which is now Brucella anthropi. And then a year later, Hort et al. Said this species is not a later heterotopic synonym of Brucella anthropi. So basically just taxonomists arguing with each other. Another group that is difficult to identify on the MALDI-TOF is the Burkholderias. Burkholderia sapacea and the sapacea complex can be very difficult to differentiate. And this is a case where you have a match to Burkholderia sepatio with the CDC library on MicrobNet at a 2.5 score. And for those of you who use MALDI-TOF, know that anything above a 2.0 is generally considered a species identification and a good score. But here's a case where you have seven different identified species named above a 2.0 score. And we see this problem with some of the different genera. And this is a consideration that I'll talk about in a second. But this is basically a red flag. If you see more than one species above a 2.0, you need to be aware that this could be a closely related complex and you may not be able to differentiate these using this instrument. So what are you supposed to do? And how do you solve the MALDI misidentification problems? First, check that your database is up to date and includes the representatives of the select agents. This is very important so that if you don't have the select agents in your database, you could be misled as getting a high score from a different species. Be wary when two species or two or more species are above a 2.0 score in the MALDI-TOF results and within 10%. So some labs use two different, if two different species are greater than 10% apart above a 2.0, they'll call those different species. So for example, that last example, if it's 2.5 and your next one was 2.1 and they're both above a 2.0, they will confidently say that that 2.5 was the correct species. We don't do that. We prefer that everything is either above or below the 2.0 line. If we can't get that resolution, then we generally use other tests to determine this. Be aware of the taxonomic synonyms in the bacterial species. Those are like the Brucella and Ochrobacterium, where they're changing the names, and that you could potentially have a problem. And check with the LRN, the LSPN, which is the list of prokaryotic names with standing in nomenclature. And the link is right here. Your state public health lab, the CDC, or MicrobNet, and you can email us at microbnet@cdc.gov if you have any questions, and we can either point you in the right direction or we can hopefully answer your question. And then I highly recommend using MicrobNet for the Bruker MALDI as it's kept up to date. It's combined with the Bruker releases and contains select agents as well as many other databases in our database collection. And then look out for your own safety, and you have to advocate for yourself. The biggest risk of MALDI-TOF is open culture exposure of an unknown. Since MALDI-TOF is so fast and so easily and readily available for those labs that are using it, it's easy to quickly want to spot something on the plate and throw it in the MALDI-TOF without taking proper precautions. In our labs, and hopefully in all the labs, treat all the isolates as unknowns until identified. And all of the BSPB, bacterial special pathogen branch, bacterial culture work is performed in a BSC with full PPE on, as shown here. Think of that biosafety cabinet space as bench space. And we really recommend whenever you're setting up the prep for the MALDI-TOF instrument, you do this in a biological safety cabinet. And we highly recommend the full tube extraction protocol, which is 10 minutes, which is the best proven method for safety. And this was a publication by Jim Rutterick in 2017. His publication studied the safety and accuracy of MALDI-TOF with the highly pathogenic organisms. And what he found was he took Bacillus anthracis, Burkholderia, Clostridia, Francisella, Yersinia, and Brucella, and he compared direct colony spotting on the plate compared to the on-plate formic acid, meaning spotting on the plate and then adding formic acid, and then a full tube extraction. And what he found was the survivability of the cells on the plate after the tube extraction killed all the cells for that species, whereas the other, the direct colony, as well as the on-plate formic acid one, still had surviving select agents. So again, we recommend the full tube extraction. It literally is only 10 minutes. It's also the fastest protocol you'll still do in the lab, even at the longest preparation method. Now, databases are important. Keep your databases up to date. And that goes to, for example, the Ochrobacter brucella. The name changes are happening. In fact, the species using genomics, there have been 1,800 species name changes in the last couple of years. And also check that for accurate taxonomic curation of the strains that are added to a database. So if you're using an in-house database, or if you're using a database that is from somebody else, make sure that what they added to that database is actually taxonomically correct, because that can get really confusing. As I said, the Ochrobacterums are now identified as brucella, and most of the commercial databases, including Bruker and Vitek, have changed this to brucella, for example, brucella anthropi, formerly Ochrobacterum in parentheses or something along those lines. We're also changing that in MicrobNet in order to let people know that this is actually an Ochrobacterum. And these can be distinguished, Ochrobacterum, the former Ochrobacterums from the former brucellas or the old brucellas can be distinguished by MALDI-TOF. So it's just the naming that's causing the confusion. And then misidentifications, if the correct species data is not in the database. And we do see this, where you have a low score, something around 1.9, 1.8, but the actual species is not in your database, you could be confused in thinking that the top result must be correct. So make sure that your scores are acceptable to the species level, which we recommend the 2.0 level, and don't just pick the top result, because that's where you can get into problems. So now I'd give a brief overview of MicrobNet and to close this out. And for those of you who haven't seen MicrobNet or aren't users, MicrobNet is an online virtual reference laboratory. You can request an account on the main page. There is a tutorial to show you how to add files to it, and then you can sign in. And this is the current dashboard where you can drag and drop your MALDI or FASTA files here to do either mass spec searching or BLAST against our 16S and ITS database. We also have a phenotypic module for biochems. So if you want to build your own virtual biochemical test tube rack, you can do that as well. The vast majority of our users use the MALDI-TOF module. And you get something that looks like this result. It's very similar to what you would see on the instrument when you're running the MALDI-TOF, except with few key differences. You can see the different databases that it matches, including MicrobNet and our partners down in Buenos Aires, Argentina. Annalise Malbrand has shared their database with us, and we host it on MicrobNet. And they are the coordinating center for MicrobNet Latin America, our partners down there. You can also click on the links that are in bold, such as the species name, and get more information on the species, including contact information at CDC, the genus information, growth conditions, as well as culture images and publications and more. So just to conclude, your safety must come first. And you know, you don't know what you're working with when you first get an isolate in the door. Even if it says what you think it might be, there have been many times where we've gotten isolates in where a lab thinks they've identified it and it turns out to be something completely different. So please work in a biosafety cabinet. Think of it more as bench space, and they are 1/25 the cost of a MALDI-TOF instrument. And they cost much less than a lab shutdown or staff comp time if you end up causing exposure in the lab. And do the full extractions. It's only 10 minutes. It's actually only 5 minutes longer than the faster method. So you're really only saving 5 minutes, and it's still the fastest method out there for bacterial identification. And every other method I can think of, like PCR and anything else, takes hours, and this is literally 10 minutes per isolate. Taxonomy is always going to be a challenge, and you need to be aware of something that could be a select agent and know that which two species are closely related and they're above 2.0. This should be an alert of a possible taxonomic issue. When in doubt, use MicrobNet. We keep our databases up to date all the time. We have multiple databases. We're going to be growing those numbers over the years, adding more databases as well. We're adding the fungal databases. We're adding Other countries will be joining us too. So please join us. If you have any questions, don't be afraid to email us at microbenet@cdc.gov. Or for those of you in Latin America, you can email our coordinating center down there at the email address shown here. And I'd just like to thank everybody that's working on MicroBNet. This is the current team working on MicroBNet and all of our partners. There are many, many more people that have worked on MicroBNet. MicroBNet celebrated its 10-year anniversary this year in January. We've been live since 2013, and many people have worked on this over the years. Our next big adventure is going to be whole genome sequencing, which will be coming later this year. So thank you. And please feel free to contact us if you have any questions at this point. I guess we can start taking questions.
Okay, yeah, we'll take a few minutes to answer as many questions as possible. If we don't get to answer your question, we will do our best to respond via email. If you have any questions after today, please email the OneLab inbox at onelab@cdc.gov. Okay, let's see. The first question, when should an ethicist CDC form 4 be submitted for suspected identification of a select agent?
You said suspected identification?
Yeah, be submitted for suspected identification of a select agent.
Well, usually they don't, if it's a suspect, we usually like to see that the sample be referred to a reference laboratory that can do a final identification for it. So that's what we prefer to have done.
Okay. If my laboratory is not immediately notified of the select identification, how soon does my laboratory need to submit the CDC Form 4?
So could you repeat that question again?
If my laboratory is not immediately notified of the select identification, how soon does my laboratory need to submit the form?
Within 7 days of the identification date is when it would be reported or should be reported to us.
Okay, and next question is, what happens if our laboratory does not submit the form?
Oh, if they don't submit the form, there's a number of things that could happen to them. We would eventually find out about it, and we would follow up with them to figure out what's going on and why they're not reporting. And there are possible penalties that could be occur because of not submitting the form.
Okay, and let's see. The next question is, how many people or labs use MicroBNet for the identification per year?
So MicroBNet is worldwide. We have 97 countries involved with 3,700 users, and we actually get hit about 155,000 times per year. So a lot of labs using MicroBNet for identifications.
I'll give you this one also, John. They want to know, I'm hearing that some clinical laboratories are no longer doing Gram stains and just testing by MALDI-TOF. What are your thoughts on this practice?
So, yeah, I would prefer that still some traditional microbiology is done, but yeah, most high throughput labs, especially the big hospitals, are going straight to MALDI, and they have decreased using pretty much anything else. We generally like to have at least two tests so that they match or that it makes sense. So I still recommend doing Gram staining or some other test that is you can confirm that what you've seen on the MALDI makes sense for you.
Last question. Do you know if ASM guidelines will change to allow MALDI extractions in place of manual methods?
I don't know of any guidelines along those lines.
Okay. All Thank you so much, Susanna and John, for joining us today. We'd like to let all the participants know that we're offering one PACE credit for today's webinar. To receive PACE credit, visit the link posted in the chat and use the passcode also in the chat and complete the evaluation within 2 weeks. You will receive an email containing these instructions after today's event. As a reminder, the slides with links will be posted to www.cdc.gov/onelab within the next 2 weeks. We will present part two of today's presentation entitled Working. I think this is wrong title. See if we can get the correct title for this for part two. Just a second. Just noticed that. It's biosafety practices in reporting occupational exposures to select agents and toxins. Again, this is part two, and of the next one lab event, which will occur on Wednesday, May 31st at 1 p.m. Again, that's Wednesday, May 31st at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The registration should be posted in the link in the chat as well. Again, I would like to say thank you for joining. Happy Lab Week and have a great rest of your day.